Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Emily Shell from Brooklyn, and you're listening to the Soundcheck from WNYC.
This is Ground Control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. All this week at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, WNYC is taking over with Radio Love Fest, our annual collaboration with BAM, featuring live versions of some of your favorite shows and podcasts. And if you're a longtime listener to this program, you'll know I'm a bit of a David Bowie fan, which is why I'll be screening the 1976 film The Man Who Fell to Earth, starring Bowie, on Thursday at BAM. That's Thursday, May 7th. And joining me at the event will be my fellow Bowie nerd, Simon Critchley, philosopher and professor here at the New School in New York, whose most recent book is called, simply, Bowie. We'll watch and talk about the film that made Bowie a screen icon, but for now, enjoy this extended version, a director's cut, if you will, of my interview with Simon from back in September. Simon, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
So we're talking about David Bowie. He is an artist of many characters.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that struck me was the idea that he was, in all his characters, someone who spoke to the characters in us, the weirdos and the freaks,
yes.
As you put it.
The weirdos, the freaks, the outsiders. It was that all the way through. Yeah.
And then the corollary to that is, if there are so many of us weirdos and freaks...
Who are the insiders?
Who are the normals?
I don't know. But he spoke to the outsiders, and he can, you know, persistently. And it's also about the shifts in persona in his work, you know, from and the rapidity of those shifts. And in the 70s, in particular, we just watched that happen. So it wasn't, as it were, one identified with one particular image, the Thin White Duke or whatever. It was the constant shifting, changing that was just so fascinating.
So from the beginning of the decade, where he's still kind of coming out of a singer-songwritery thing,
through long hair and all that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Through glam, mm-hmm. To the more soulful sounds of Young Americans, and then the Thin White Duke and Berlin,
yeah.
And all of that. So is this appeal to the freaks and the weirdos, is it a kind of constant thing, or is he gathering different freaks and weirdos with each incarnation?
Different freaks and weirdos, but I mean, he gathered me when I was 12 years old. You know, it was that moment I was watching July the 6th, 1972, Top of the Pops, Starman. It was a moment that millions of people shared in Britain.
There's a star.
Can you explain to American listeners the thunderclap that was Top of the Pops that night?
Well, so Top of the Pops is this hugely, hugely influential show, watched by about a quarter of the British population. And I was watching it one night with my mother and sister, and he came on doing Starman. And then my mother, who'd been a hairdresser in Liverpool, she bought the single. She bought Starman. But the real moment of revelation for me was watching, seeing him and seeing this creature, this kind of alien creature, and there was something just alluring about him. But then I went into the dining room and looked at the single cover, flipped it over and played Suffragette City. And I can still remember the effect that that had on my body, just listening to that Mick Ronson's guitar sound. It didn't compute. It made no sense. There was just this noise and it felt good. And that was, I think, was my sexual awakening. And so there was that, and then it just kept on happening. It kept on. And so for me, I guess the high point, people have different high points, but for me, I guess it's Side One of Heroes when that comes out. So it's the so-called Berlin period, or that's a little bit overdone. But that sound on Side One of Heroes, when he's got everything together, he's got Fripp doing his thing, but he's also got Dennis Davis, George Murray, this great sort of
rhythm section.
Great rhythm, American rhythm section. And it's funky and it's sort of dense and layered. And I just thought, this is what music should sound like. I was 17 by that time.
Yeah, so right in the sweet spot. Side One and Side Two of Heroes for me also just, you know, it's one of the pinnacles of, you know,
Secret
music
Life,
for me.
Yeah, Secret Life of Arabia. I mean, that's...
I was so happy to hear you, to see you write about that song, which is the last song on the record.
Right.
So talk about a deep cut, but it's a great song.
You mean, what is the song about? I've got no idea. The Secret Life of Arabia. It's kind of bizarre. But it's funky. This is an amazing hand clap sequence, and you know it takes you somewhere else. There is no more important artist of the last five decades than David Bowie in any field, in visual or anything. Nothing, nobody comes close to what Bowie has done for me. And the book is an attempt to kind of take this guy as seriously as he should be taken.
A few years ago, when MySpace was the thing and every band had its MySpace page, there was the little thing about influences off to the side. You would, you know, location, date, influences, etc.
Yeah.
So somebody, might have been MySpace itself, combed through all of those pages to see who the most influential artists were. And Bowie was number one.
Really?
He was the most mentioned in all of those band pages on MySpace.
Good. I think that's right. I mean, for me, at the moment, there's that movie, you know, the movie Control
about
Joy Division?
Joy Division, yeah.
And I didn't like it the first time I saw it, but watched it over the summer again. But it begins with that scene of Ian Curtis in flared trousers walking back from the record store with an album under his arm. And it's a Bowie album, and he's collecting news clippings of Bowie, and he's then applying mascara to his eyes. And that's how it was, you know. And so there'd be obviously no Joy Division without Bowie,
right,
without what he was doing with Iggy. But yeah, I mean, just a massive influence. And the influence, it faded a bit. There's been periods, there have been kind of difficult periods to be a Bowie fan, but the kind of, the body of work is astonishing, I think.
Well, and, you know, there are certain themes that have run through his, you have a really interesting obsession with the word nothing in his songs.
Though nothing, nothing will keep us together. We can beat them forever and ever.
You know, yeah, in the song Heroes, we're nothing and nothing can help us.
Nothing,
but you can find nothings all through Bowie,
yeah,
to the point that nothing is not a lack.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing itself somehow.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we're nothing.
Was that way too philosophical?
No, but I think for me there's something. I mean, Bowie is, there's a really long answer to this that I won't go into, but he faces up to the question of nihilism, the question of nothing. And that theme of nothing, you know, persists from very early stuff, from Man Who Sold the World right through to Heathen and beyond. And it's a kind of, for me, the nothing which is at the core of Bowie isn't some kind of, you know, contemplation of the void so much as a kind of nothing, as a kind of yearning for love.
Mm.
What defines Bowie's music, what people often say about Bowie, it's about solitude, a kind of distant, alien sexuality or whatever. That's not really it. What Bowie's music is about is a kind of yearning for connection. In Station to Station, who will connect me with love?
Keep searching and searching, oh, what will I be believing?
there's a kind of massive yearning for connection, for love, and that nothing of love that will light things up is what he seems to be after in songs like Survive, 515, Angels Have Gone. There's a whole number of them.
And another theme is the theme of acting, you know, from songs from Hunky Dory, half the songs on Hunky Dory, the liner notes to which he refers to himself as the actor, mm-hmm. to the song Cracked Actor, to what we just heard in Secret Life of Arabia, you know, you must see the movie, The mm-hmm. Sand in My Eyes. The idea of this performance art as a kind of cinema.
Yeah, I mean, constantly, you know, he sees himself as an actor inside a movie. It's there from, you know, Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell him apart at all, through to, I mean, the whole Diamond Dogs conceit is a conceit of acting and cinema. And that leads, for me, to the question of authenticity, right? Mm. So there's something supremely inauthentic about Bowie's work. It's self-conscious, it's reflective, he's constantly aware of what he's doing, but that doesn't mean it's not true. Right. Mm-hmm. So for me, one of the main philosophical points I'm making in the book is to try and separate truth from authenticity and say that Bowie's work is supremely inauthentic, self-conscious, constructed, all of that. But it still makes this powerful claim on us, a powerful truth claim at a kind of visceral level. And so, you know, and that, I think, enables us to see music in a different way. Music is it's a pretense, it's acting, it's always theatre, right? It doesn't mean it's false. It works in a different way.
Speaking of working in a different way, do you think English and American Bowie fans have had different experiences of Bowie over the years?
I'd like to ask you that, actually. You know, I think so. I mean, when I've talked to people, yes, there are differences. Yeah, it's Ziggy, it's glam, and then it's what happens in punk and post punk. I think Bowie's success in the US is differently kind of spread out. There's the Young Americans moment. Mm-hmm. And then there's... how was it for you?
Well, you know, I grew up here in New York. And mm-hmm. I was a teenager at the first flowering of punk and had been a Bowie fan. And to mm-hmm. me, the surprise was it wasn't just like punk came in and was like, kill your idols. It was almost like punk came in and said, kill your idols except for that one.
That's
that,
right.
That Bowie guy.
That's right.
He's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I could never put my finger on what it was about Bowie that was okay, you know, to the kind of destructive, youthful exuberance, you know, clear everything out of my way approach of the first wave of
punks. Bowie survived punk by kind of ignoring it and then being... when I was, I'm 54 years old, so year zero was 1976 and we had three bands, the MC5, the Velvet Underground and Iggy and the Stooges, and plus Bowie. And maybe Roxy Music as well, but certainly Bowie. And Bowie has been constantly cool for 50 years. And I mean, how does one explain that? There's a kind of discipline he has as an artist, which I think is misunderstood, that he never stopped listening and reading. He's obviously a voracious reader of books and everything. And so when he was at the peak of his fame, this is in that lovely Cracked Actor documentary that's made in 1974 that then inspired Nicholas Roeg to pick him up for The Man Who Fell to Earth. But you see Bowie in the back of a limo and he's listening at that point to Aretha Franklin, a lot of soul music, and he's reading. And he could be just out of his mind on drugs, you know, mm-hmm. wallowing in his success. But Bowie kept moving and there was a kind of just sheer intelligence that he had, which I think is, you know, the question that I guess the book raises, well, what other figures are there like that, that we can really compare Bowie to? Are there figures that have changed, developed over that period and not just turned into a kind of parody of themselves that repeats?
Although there have been periods where it's been hard to be a Bowie fan.
Yeah.
I remember reading, before Let's Dance came out, reading about the contract that he signed, major record label. Big multi-album contract, huge amount of money for the day. This would have been like, what, early 80s, 81, 82. And I remember thinking, all right, fair enough. You've been this extraordinary artist for a decade and you haven't made any money off it. So go ahead and make your money. Just come back to us at some point.
Yeah, and he did.
And he did.
The 80s were a bad decade, all those Iggy covers that... he shouldn't have done, even China Girl. And but Bowie,
now, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that you know, it was just like, all right, Let's Dance is okay, but man, you wrote China Girl with Iggy, and it was a great song.
It's a great song.
And now it's like, the original version of China Girl.
Yeah, on the Idiot.
On the Idiot, one of the records that Bowie did in Germany with Iggy Pop, where Iggy devolves from words to just this kind of gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
It's in the whites of my eyes.
In the whites of my eyes. Oh, but, Lord. So, I'm going to start crying.
I stole money into town, just like a sacred cow. Vision the swastika in my head, and plans for everyone. It's in the wind. My little China girl, you shouldn't.
All right, the original version of China Girl from Iggy Pop's album The Idiot. Bowie co-wrote it, produced it. If you didn't know he was singing It's in the Whites of My Eyes, it's just a cry of the heart at that point.
Absolutely searing, yeah.
But in the 80s, Bowie comes back to some of the work he did with Iggy.
Yeah.
And this is what we get.
I stumble into town, just like a sacred cow. Visions of swastikas in my head.
So Bowie is more crooning by the end of the song.
Yeah.
There's the cry of pain is not there, it seems.
No, it's a very different tune.
It's a very different
there
song.
There are other examples. There are worse examples. The song Tonight by Iggy, which is an absolutely extraordinary thing on Lust for Life. But Bowie came back, you know, and Bowie, it took a long time. There's Black Tie, White Noise, which is... got some good moments, but then Outside in 95, for me, was just like, I was so happy.
Yeah.
Not that it was just working with Eno, but it just made sense and it was coherent.
Outside for me was also the return. It was like, oh, you're back.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, working with Eno. The production on that album is extraordinary. You can listen to it 100 times and find something new buried in the layers. But the storytelling of that album.
Well, there's little narrative conceits, the little vocal sequences in between, but also just some great, great tracks on that. And it's got that kind of compressed production, which is it's a bit muddy in a really good way.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so happy. I was dancing around a kitchen, my girlfriend's kitchen in Stockholm. I remember playing that on cassette over and over again. Yeah, delirious.
And the idea that, I have not been to Oxford Town, that has the sort of the 20th century dies?
I have not been to Oxford Town, 20th century. Yeah, is that song.
That Bowie kind of places his work. It's 1995 and he's thinking of the end of the century and he's kind of telling you about it right there in the song.
Yeah.
I found that striking.
Yeah, there's something, I mean, a theme which I try and bring out is this, there's this dystopia in Bowie, which is, it's a big theme and it interests me a lot, but there's a kind of sense of the world as ruined, a kind of civilizational collapse. It's there, obviously, in Diamond Dogs. Future Legend is basically that. And there's a persistent sort of emphasis upon the world as a kind of ruined, dangerous place. Mm-hmm. And in that, art becomes possible as some kind of resistance. So I see in Bowie a kind of dystopia on the one hand and this sort of persistent kind of utopianism on the other hand. There's a kind of yearning after something else, something transformational, something almost vaguely religious as well about his work. There's a kind of, there are elements of that. But the, I think what changed with Bowie in the early 70s when he became popular was kind of the background in the way that the whole, you know, peace, love and revolution, late 60s thing in Britain had faded out very badly, and Bowie's kind of pessimism just hit a kind of nerve, and this idea that there was some alien possibility out there, Starman and all the rest. And also another thing about Bowie, which I think is, I don't know whether this is true or not, but certainly it was the case for me, was the class sense of this. This Bowie spoke very strongly to working class boys and girls, who are working class boys and girls in very kind of homophobic environments. And this kind of androgynous creature showed up, and the world, we didn't want to be in the streets and be in the world. We wanted something impossibly glamorous and strange, and Bowie seemed to offer that.
The idea of dystopia, utopia, those ideas come back again. Bowie has lived here in New York for many years after 9/11. Mm-hmm. The album that came out in 2012, Heathen, people saw that as a post 9/11 record, but the fact is most of that was done before.
It was recorded before, yeah.
On the other hand, a song like New Killer Stars, which starts out by talking about the great white scar over Battery Park. I mean, that seems as close as Bowie is willing to get to, like, putting his finger on a specific event in a specific place and time.
See the great white scar over Battery Park. Then the flare flies over, but I won't look at that scar.
Lots of sort of New York-specific references in Bowie, particularly in Heathen and Reality. And Reality is a great album, which is, I think, underestimated. And, there's a sense in which, you know, this is... I don't know why he chose to live here. I mean, this is his home. This is his place, which is his, you know, a place in numb place.
Has Bowie... I mean, you were 12 when you first saw Starman, Top of the Pops. At some point, you would have been 14, 15, and probably itching to form a band like every 14 or 15-year-old boy,
absolutely,
especially
yeah.
those who've... and it's taken a while, but you now have a band, right?
Sort of, yeah. a secret, strange secret thing with my friend John, who lives in Australia. Yeah.
So this is Critchley and Simmons?
Yeah.
And is this... I mean, how big an ingredient in this musical stew is David Bowie?
Oh, complete ingredient. So, I mean, me and my friend John, we were both huge Bowie fans, but also huge, you know, soul and funk fans. And it was that kind of stew that was peculiar. You know, why would people that, you know, we were, you know, in this homophobic, basically racist environment, but we grew up listening to Stax, Parliament, Funkadelic, whatever, and Bowie, and that. So when Heroes happens, and when, you know, even when Young American, Station to Station, when he's working with basically an American rhythm section, it kind of makes sense to us intuitively. And it's that kind of fusion between whatever sensibility we call Bowie, that conceptual sensibility, together with, you know, just really good driving R&B.
So would it embarrass you if I played a little bit of your music?
Yes. But please go ahead. Please go ahead.
Right,
my vanity exceeds my embarrassment.
This is from Critchley and Simmons. Their album is called Majesty of the Absurd, and the song is Out of My Mind.
Bull is under bugle, bird under ox eye. Blessed Jesus, Rankel, me and my cat.
a jet fry. My body's electricity, my balls are dynamite. And you can feel my cosmic energy lighting up the desert night. My sister has a budgie, he weaves his body around. He speaks to me of Kabbalah and tells me of his holy ground. I yawn and bring forth locusts, I spit and cities fry. I hold apocalypse in my armpits. Look at me if you want to die.
So that is my guest, Simon Critchley, in his alter ego as half of the band Critchley and Simmons.
That was
weird. Out of my mind.
That was strange.
Is that the first time your stuff has been heard on the radio?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned the kind of the funk and the soul sound, certainly there. Maybe not too dissimilar from what we would have heard from someone like Talking Heads circa 1979, 1980 as well.
I accept the compliment,
but
I couldn't possibly speak. I mean, the bass line, which we lifted from Prince, we kind of adapted that bass line from Prince, and the rest is kind of, it's Christopher Smart's Jubilate Agno. It's based on President Schreiber's Memoirs of My Nervous Illness. It's a kind of crazy fusion of, I do the words and he does the music.
Okay.
It's,
Well, you know, this. Here's another thing that did strike me about your book. A lot of talk about the words, a lot of talk about the characters.
Yes.
Less about the actual music.
Yeah. You know?
Is the key to Bowie in the words for you?
Well, I want to do the words justice. I mean, you know, the book, you know, I think that my view is that, I mean, you know, pop music, let's just say pop music, just still isn't really given its due as the importance of it to the way in which just, you know, what it means to people. And we have music journalism, which is fine. We have social history. We have bits of dime store psychology, biography and all of that. But it's to do something that wasn't any of that, to try and give his music its due as art, you know, to do a kind of literary criticism of some of the songs. So I'm not musically really competent, you know, but I'm good with words, and I know how to read poems and things like that. So in a sense, I did a book on Wallace Stevens about 10, 12 years ago. And for me, you know, to try and approach Bowie's lyrics as if it was a Stevens poem, to take it seriously, to try and break it down and look at the conceits, the images, what he's doing with language, it's not the whole thing, but it's part of it. And so there are a couple of songs I deal with. The song Sunday from Heathen. I go through a lot of stuff from Diamond Dogs. And I think, you know, it repays that kind of attention. Because when I read stuff about Bowie, I'm often not appalled, that's the wrong word, but it's not reverent enough. He's just, you know, a great major artist, and his work is in the detail,
right?
To get into the grain of those tracks and to look what he's doing with words and really attend to that, I think is part of what I'm trying to do.
For me, you know, over the years, especially during those kind of lean years for us Bowie fans, great years for Bowie when he was making all that money with pop music. But, you know, I always was concerned that, oh, my God, I'm going to turn into one of those guys who thinks that music died in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
So Bowie's return to form with Outside in 95 was great. And then there was the 10 missing years until the surprise release of The Next Day last year. And for me, the great thing about The Next Day was I liked it. A lot.
Yeah,
and there were songs there that I thought were among his best.
Mm-hmm.
For me,
I remember very clearly, the guy John I do the music with, and three other people emailed me from different parts of the world. I got up at 8 o'clock in the morning in Brooklyn, and there was the video, you know, Where Are We Now? And I couldn't believe it was there, you know, and it was that feeling of just sheer joy. And then the album came out. And there's also this exhibition, David Bowie Is. It was in London.
Now it's in Chicago.
It's going to become Chicago next week, and they're going to do a really good job. But when I was there in London seeing it, what really struck me was I was in this huge space. They were playing videos. It was the end of the exhibition. There's this kind of video sequence they use. And people were just happy, right? Mm. People were just happy that David Bowie is alive. He's producing music, and we're alive, and we're still doing stuff as well. So in a sense, he didn't stick a gun in his mouth when he was 27. He didn't burn out like that. He's carried on. He's endured, and there's a kind of an ethic to that, which I think is also worthy of respect. And it's really hard to do good music, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Lord knows. I mean, to keep at it and to keep it relevant and sharp, and the work survives, and there's an integrity to it. And thank God for that.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure you have your favorites off the next day. I have mine.
Oh, what's your favorite?
I like the Heat, the Scott Walker song at the end.
Oh yeah.
I really think The Stars Are Out Tonight is just a great rock song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you don't mind, that's where we're going to leave it.
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
Great video as well.
Yes, with, what's her name?
Tilda Swinton,
right. Simon Critchley has been with us on Soundcheck. He is the Hans Jonas Professor of Philosophy at the New School for Social Research here in New York, author of numerous books, but the most recent one is his book called Simply Bowie. Simon, it has been great fun.
It's a total
geeking
pleasure.
Out with you.
Absolutely.
Simon Critchley, the philosopher and professor now based at the New School here in New York. He will join me on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music on Thursday, May 7th, prior to a screening of the 1976 Bowie movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth. I hope you'll join us, too. Details on this and all of the Radio Love Fest events this week at BAM can be found online at wnyc.org/radiolovefest. Last move, so-